Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, local pensions make a comeback. Candidate lists are finalized, and the first presidential debate is less than 2 weeks away. Attorney and local government expert Chris Hand joins us to discuss all that and more. Later in the program, why community revitalization programs are facing roadblocks from regulators. But first, I'm joined as I am each time this month by attorney and local government expert Chris Hand for a look at the latest in city and state headlines. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann. Great to see you.
Great to see you as well. Thank you for being here. I think let's start with pensions, because this was a topic that was huge. You lived through it. There was much gnashing of teeth, concerns about how it was going to buckle, you know, our budget, bankrupt system. And now here we are. It's coming full circle. So catch us up on where we are right now with a proposal to bring pensions back for first responders.
Sure. And just to give a little bit of a scope where we've been, this issue really, with all due respect to Paul McCartney, this has really been the long and winding road of an issue that's persisted now for about 15 years at the city of Jacksonville. City had to work on this significantly during the Great Recession. As you say, it was a big portion of the Brown administration in which I served. We actually ended that 4 years with an agreement that would have kept police and fire employees in the then city defined benefit pension plan, but also tried to make those benefits, particularly for new employees, sustainable for taxpayers over time, lowered it to about 10% of pay. During the subsequent administration, a decision was made to shift new employees to a defined contribution plan, kind of like a 401k, a variation of that for new employees, and with about a 25% match from the city of Jacksonville, so kind of increasing those costs to the city. The new proposal that's on the table in the current administration, as a result of negotiations, collective bargaining with the firefighters union and you know, ultimately the police union, the sheriff's union, is to, for new employees starting in 2027, to give them the option to go into the Florida retirement system. Right now, every county except for Duval County and some other localities place their employees in the Florida retirement system. So those benefits are set by the state. The cost for the city for those benefits also set by the state. City doesn't really have any role in that. So it's putting police and fire employees, at least new ones who make that election starting in 2027, back into a defined benefit plan, but one run by the city as by the state as opposed to by the city of Jacksonville.
And I'm guessing in all of the discussions that surrounded this debate 7 years ago under the Curry administration, I mean, they had to get buy-in from the unions to switch to this 401k plan. They had to have a vote of the taxpayers to extend the Better Jacksonville plan to help pay for pension down the road. Surely this must have been discussed.
Well, I think there's a variety of issues that go into these pension discussions, or at least there were during the very intense analysis we did during our administration. One is, what's the impact on recruitment and retention? One of the reasons we decided to stay within the defined benefit model is we were concerned that if you had a defined contribution model, that might encourage police officers, firefighters, first responders to go to other jurisdictions.
And we should be clear, a defined benefit is a traditional pension. A defined contribution is more like a 401k.
Exactly right. Defined benefit meaning that you have some guaranteed kind of return at the end. Obviously, a defined contribution type plan can sort of move up and down, you know, with the market. We were concerned that recruitment and retention would be impacted if the city made a shift from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. It seems that there is some evidence that that has been the case over the last several years. And, you know, obviously, you know, any public employee, but particularly police and fire, have a great interest and a very well-deserved interest in retirement security. I mean, these are public servants who are running into burning buildings, who are facing bullets, potentially violent criminal acts, and so want to, after their years of public service, make sure they have retirement security. You know, the key for the city of Jacksonville or any local government is to strike that appropriate balance. How do we make sure those very well-deserving, hardworking public servants have retirement security, but do so in a way that is fiscally sustainable for the taxpayers? We actually, when we looked at the different options we considered, staying in the city of Jacksonville defined benefit plan, going to a defined contribution plan, or joining the FRS, we found that both the defined contribution and the FRS option at that time, and again, times have changed, but at that time, we weren't sure we were going to be able to strike that balance in terms of retirement security and fiscal security for the taxpayers. That's something that the new administration and the city council have to weigh that balance now as they're sort of making these decisions for future benefits.
But in terms of the discussion around FRS and going to the state system, was it primarily a cost prohibition that prevented, for instance, the Brown administration that you worked for from going that route?
There was two main factors. One was cost. And again, this was a time where, city revenues really took a hit because of the Great Recession. So again, a little bit of a different circumstance than now. But cost was a big issue. Right now, and I'll use kind of 2024 numbers, right now the state retirement system charges localities about 33% of pay for employees in the Florida retirement system who are in the so-called special risk category, meaning they are first responders, essentially. The other issue that we faced in looking at FRS is typically local governments lose their Social Security exemption when they join FRS. So right now, the City of Jacksonville defined benefit plan for both first responders and general employees is what's called a Social Security replacement plan. City employees don't pay into Social Security as a result of that. If you go back to FRS, and again, perhaps the city is working with it on this, on this issue with the state, but if you go back to FRS, traditionally, you're also now paying Social Security as well. So as we know, that's about a 6.2% of pay contribution for the city. So you're now up from 33%, which the state is charging, to about 40%. And then there's another determination as well. Will the city also pay the employee share of Social Security, which is 6.2%? Because if you don't, that could sort of amount to a bit of an unintended pay cut for employees as well. So those are some of the fiscal issues that will have to be worked out here. I've actually made a public records request for any actuarial or cost studies the city has done to sort of, evaluate what those costs might be, see what they, will be over the long term. I have not received a response to that yet, but I'll be very curious to look at those actuarial studies and see what sort of long-term fiscal impact is here. There's no question that police officers and firefighters need to have a secure retirement, and we want to make sure that they are wanting to have their careers here at the City of Jacksonville. We can retain and retain existing employees and recruit new ones. But again, it's all about striking that balance. And, what is the city's fiscal capability over the long term?
Sure. The discussion right now seems to be a lot around recruitment and retention and the hit that took because the city moved away from a traditional pension plan. But initially, the conversation was about cost. This is a $3 billion pension plan. Theoretically, these changes were going to save some money. I think I hadn't realized until being reminded, at least recently, by our colleague Nate Monroe, that the city does a 25% match into the 401k for police and fire. So that's a pretty significant contribution. It's not an inexpensive plan. We still have $3 billion worth of pension debt. And now we would possibly be shifting to a system that your administration, when you worked for the Brown administration, found would be too expensive. So is there, I know you're asking for that actuarial review, but has any of this, these movements changed the financial picture? Anything saved money or put us in a better footing on our pension debt?
Well, as you sort of alluded to, kind of the numbers tell the story a little bit. As you say, there's a nearly $3 billion unfunded liability or pension debt in the police and fire pension fund. Just to make sure everyone understands what that means, it means that our obligations to pay pensions are $3 billion more than the actual assets the fund has on hand to pay those right now. This is actually an increase over the last several years. Right now, in this coming fiscal year, the budget the mayor's about to propose in July, the city's going to contribute about $180 million over the next year to help kind of fund pensions for police and fire employees, and of course another contribution for general employees and corrections employees as well. So there are very significant numbers that we are dealing with now.
And to be clear, that money is going into that payment because it's otherwise not funded sufficiently.
Correct. That's right. Much of that payment the city makes each year, is to help pay down the unfunded liability. And also another portion is the actual cost of the pension benefits for first responders as well. That'll be something important to track going forward. Now, as we know, in the next several years, there is going to be a new revenue source coming in to help pay down the unfunded liability. You know, when voters, as you said, several years ago, voted to kind of adopt these new plans and shift what was the Better Jacksonville Plan infrastructure task to paying for pensions in 2030. And that date is now definitive because that's obviously been impacted a little bit by some of these stadium discussions. But in 2030, that half penny sales tax revenue each year will now go into helping to pay down the pension debt. So that will provide, I think, some relief to this situation. But again, it's all about that balance, figuring out what are the revenue sources we have to help pay down kind of this unfunded liability? What are the costs of pensions? And that's going to be a key factor in the city's decision to shift back to FRS. Understand certainly their thinking on that to kind of help deal with some of these recruitment and retention issues, make sure that first responders have secure retirements, which is very important. But I think also important for the council and taxpayers to understand what is that long-term fiscal impact and what sort of fiscal planning. If the city of Jacksonville has made that policy decision to go back to the defined benefit model with FRS, what sort of fiscal planning is happening to make sure that those costs can be covered in the future and we don't find ourselves back in the same pension situation that we've been in for a number of years?
Yeah, and as you say, the stadium negotiations to some extent will push further down the road, beginning to address that debt through the Better Jacksonville Plan funding.
Correct, by 4 years. It was originally supposed to, the Curry administration had sort of moved up the time period when those additional revenues would come in to help pay down pension debt. As a result of the way they're going to finance the stadium, that will now revert back to what had been the original plan, 2030, to have those revenues coming in. But again, I think important not to be able to keep sort of revisiting the pension issue time and time again. First of all, for employees' benefit, they need to know what their retirement benefits are so they can plan appropriately for that, but also for taxpayers so that going forward, the city of Jacksonville can have a fiscally sustainable pension system that meets that balance I talked about earlier.
So Randy Reeves, he's the head of the Fraternal Order of Police. That's the local police union. He, you know, this is not a done deal yet. It still has to be approved by the membership and by the council and all of that. But it appears to be a deal that's been struck by the Deegan administration. He was interviewed about this. He actually called it the best contract ever. Let's hear a little bit about what he had to say.
It means a lot for us here locally. It gets us back on par with the other 66 out of 67 counties in Florida that have a pension, have a defined benefit. 7 years ago, a previous administration sold us that we would move away from the pension and that we would be the first of many agencies to move away from a pension. 7 years later, here we are, and we're still the only county in the state of Florida that does not have a defined benefit for their first responders.
So he's sort of opaquely referencing a previous administration, that was the Curry administration, that moved firefighters and police away from that defined benefit plan. So why is Deegan able to sort of reap the benefit? I mean, you would think that that would be a little bit more difficult for her. She's not a Republican, and typically the police and fire union have supported Republican candidates. They did in this race. They supported her opponent. But she seems to be reaping the benefits of political benefits of this deal with police and fire.
Well, I think there's a couple of factors here. Number one, I think there is a genuine concern both at the city of Jacksonville level, at the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, at the Jacksonville Fire Rescue Department, about these recruitment and retention issues. That was something that, again, we and even the Payton administration before us had identified as a potential challenge if you shift it over. So I think there's a legitimate concern about that. Very important that we be able to retain first responder employees at the city of Jacksonville and recruit new ones. And I think Mr. Reeves is correct. Jacksonville was at a competitive disadvantage with the other 66 counties in the state and a variety of other kind of local governments because they were able to offer defined benefit, particularly through the FRS. In terms of Mayor Deegan, and you know, again, I think she shares that genuine concern about recruitment and retention. That's a big deal for a mayor to make sure you can adequately staff your first responders. I think she's also been, you know, kind of politically close to organized labor, maybe not particularly police or firefighters in terms of the last election, but I think someone who, you know, over time has shown some support for organized labor. But I think there's a third factor here. One of the issues in terms of our kind of pension odyssey here in the city of Jacksonville is typically, and this is true not just for Jacksonville, but cities and counties around the country, when governments agree to new pension benefits or a new pension system, that there's a delayed effect to that. In other words, that the bill for that typically doesn't come due until future administrations. So I think we've seen that, again, not just here in the city of Jacksonville, but in a variety of other places. Elected officials, you know, can give pension benefits, knowing that the fiscal impact of those may not happen until later years. There might not be an immediate fiscal impact. I'm not suggesting, you know, that calculus has gone in for the Deegan administration, but I think it's why it's very important that we see these actuarial and cost studies. It's not only a best practice to run those before you make a pension shift. In some cases, it's a legal requirement. I think very important for the council, for taxpayers to understand what is this long-term fiscal impact. That doesn't mean you don't make the same decision, but it makes sure that you are aware of what the, you know, what the coming costs might be so that you can plan for those in the long-term budgeting that you're doing at the city.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are talking with local government expert and attorney Chris Hand. He joins us monthly to talk about the latest state and local headlines. If you want to join our conversation, you can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. I want to move on, Chris, to a non-pension topic, although I'm sure we'll come back to that. But the presidential debate, the first presidential debate, is less than 2 weeks away between former President Trump, current President Biden. What are you going to be looking for in that debate? It's a historic, unusual. It's going to have some interesting new rules.
It is a historical oddity in that, you know, in the now almost 70 years since televised presidential debates began, this is the first one that's going to be kind of this early. Neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump have actually even been officially nominated for their to be their party's candidates yet. They're going to meet on June 27th at CNN Studios in Atlanta. No studio audience, just the two candidates and the two moderators, Jake Tapper and Dana Bash from CNN. It'll be 90 minutes, a couple of commercial breaks, and the candidates' microphones will be muted when they are not speaking. So when President Biden's speaking, President Trump's mic will be muted, and vice versa. It is a very different situation, and the stakes are very high for this debate, really for both candidates. As we know, they have been sort of stuck in a more or less a dead heat for months. President Trump maintained a very small, within the margin of error, lead in both national polls and some swing state polls. That has begun to shift a little bit following his conviction on 34 felony counts in a New York state court, where President Biden now just seems to have a little bit of a lead in a couple of polls. But really, the race is essentially a dead heat. This will be the first time since 2020 that voters have seen these two candidates side by side. And like I said, I think the stakes are high for both of them. For President Biden, you know, whether it is kind of inflation or whether it's concerned about his age or other issues, his approval ratings have been fairly frozen and static for quite some time now. This might be the most important moment in his political career because he has an opportunity to define the choice between himself and former President Trump and lay out the stakes of the election. For former President Trump, I mean, obviously, we've had some recent history on that. On May 31st, he became the first president of the United States to become a convicted felon because of those 34 counts. He's going to be sentenced on those on July the 11th. That is a development that has obviously had a little bit of impact in the polls, particularly with those key independent voters, a third of whom say that makes them less likely to vote for him. So this is his moment to help address some of those issues that have been happening. See if he can kind of regain the momentum in the race. I would argue that over the history of presidential debates, it's hard to think of one that's potentially more impactful than this one.
Talk about the mic muting element of that, because I feel like very often the sound bites, the moments from presidential debates or high profile debates come during those perhaps, you know, less guarded moments or interchanges between people, maybe someone stepping on someone else's moment and getting out their response. So very often, you know, those memorable moments are built on things that people interjected as opposed to waited patiently for and responded to. And so that will change somewhat what we hear out of the candidates.
Well, it will. I mean, if you go back to the 2000 presidential campaign, you know, in the first debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush, the big issue, or one of the big issues coming out of the debate, was whether or not then Vice President Gore was sighing during, you know, some of the comments that ultimately President Bush was making during the debate. So you're right. There's a history of those kind of nonverbal, kind of off-camera communications having an impact. I think this is a direct result of the 2020 debates, where there was concern about candidates talking over each other, interrupting other candidates as they were trying to give responses. I would imagine this is something that particularly the Biden campaign insisted upon when they were kind of hashing out the debate rules with CNN. So we won't get some of that that sort of off-camera commentary because the mics will be muted. Also puts a lot of emphasis on the two moderators, again, Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, in terms of the way they will structure this debate, because, again, there won't be a studio audience. It'll just be the two candidates and the two moderators in the CNN studio in Atlanta. And really encourage all listeners here, tune into the debate. It's a you know, really important chance to see these two candidates side by side.
2024 elections are going to be big here locally as well. So beyond the presidential race, we've got a lot of candidates lining up for some contested seats here, particularly Duval County School Board is a big one. What races, now that we have a, now that qualifying is closed and we have our list of candidates, what races are most interesting to you?
Well, yeah, there's going to be higher profile races like the race for president, and there's a U.S. Senate race here on the ballot in Florida as well. I'm always very interested in kind of the local government races that are happening, because that's the level of government kind of closest to the electorate that can have the most immediate and direct impact on our lives. And there are a number of, even though we just had City of Jacksonville elections last year, there are still a number of local government contests on the ballot. Probably the most significant are the Duval County School Board. There are seven total seats on the school board. A majority of those four are going to be contested in August of 2024. In District 1, incumbent Kelly Coker is not running for a second term, so there are two candidates running for that race. In District 3, incumbent Cindy Pearson is running for re-election. She's being challenged by a single candidate. In District 5, school board member Warren Jones is term limited. He's not running again, and there are three candidates to succeed him. And in District 7, incumbent Lori Hershey, again, also term limited, and two candidates to succeed her. You've talked a lot on this program recently, Ann, about the huge stakes for the Duval County Public Schools right now. There's a new superintendent. They're dealing with unprecedented sort of perfect storm of fiscal issues and a variety of other issues, including student achievement. The stakes are really high for the future of the Duval County schools, and this election's going to go a long way toward determining what vision the school board adopts, what policies it adopts to deal with these challenges and seek opportunities for the Duval County schools going forward.
Sure, and a number of school closures are going to be front and center for those candidates.
That's right. I mean, these new members or returning members, depending on how the election goes to the school board, are going to immediately be thrust into issues like, what about that proposed school closure plan? How do we deal with that? What oversight is provided of the new superintendent? How do they deal with some of these other fiscal issues like the Universal School Choice Plan, which has obviously had a huge impact on the operational funding? So these are all candidates for office who are going to enter the Duval County School Board, if they're elected, at a time where there are major both financial and operational challenges to deal with. But, you know, those are not the only local government contests on the ballot. And, you know, in our unique consolidated structure, while the city of Jacksonville is merged with Duval County, there are still some individual local governments, in particularly in the Beaches area, Atlantic, Neptune, and Jacksonville Beach. All three of the Beaches communities are electing mayors in 2024. In Atlantic Beach, the incumbent mayor, Curtis Ford, is being challenged by a former mayor, Ellen Glasser. In Neptune Beach, Mayor Elaine Brown is term limited, so there are two candidates running for that seat. And in Jacksonville Beach, Mayor Christine Hoffman's running for re-election. She's being challenged by a former city council, Jacksonville Beach City Council member, Georgette Dumont. So if you live in one of those communities, your local government is going to be significantly impacted by the results of those elections, which will, you know, happen over the course of 2024.
Sure, and we'll be looking at those in St. Augustine and Orange Park and Green Cove as well. So a lot of big elections. We're talking about state and local headlines with Chris Hand, and you can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937, or you can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I want to touch on some budget matters at the state level. So this week, the governor signed his budget. He, you know, I think walked away with some bragging rights in terms of lower taxes, a smaller budget than the previous year, but it also came with a number of vetoes, as it typically does. So those, that announcement happened late last week. I think there's a lot of agencies, particularly arts agencies, that are still reacting to the news that they're not going to get the money that they expected.
Well, that's right. I mean, so the overall state budget is $116 billion. The governor vetoed almost $1 billion in kind of spending from that budget. And as you say, there were several impacts that really jumped out. One was the governor vetoed all arts and cultural grants, which was about $35 million in the budget. This is real money for a lot of these nonprofits that sort of rely on that state funding and has the potential to impact a variety of organizations in Northeast Florida. If you go look at sort of the grants list for the Florida Secretary of State, you'll see a lot of familiar names: the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra, the Florida Theater, the Cultural Council of Greater Northeast Florida, the First Coast Cultural Center, Florida State College at Jacksonville Foundation, the Cathedral Arts Project. So there's a number of Northeast Florida organizations, Duval, St. John's, Clay, other places that are now, because these grants have been vetoed, are not going to receive that sort of money in the incoming fiscal year. So that's a matter of great concern for cultural organizations kind of around the state. And one of the news accounts of these cuts, they quoted the head of a cultural organization who said, you know, we woke up the next morning and started figuring out things we could do to cut money out of our budget. So that was a matter of concern. There's also been sort of locally, while there were a number of higher education projects that were funded at the University of North Florida, you know, the additional money for the proposed University of Florida graduate campus here in Jacksonville, some money for Flagler College. There was also some higher education projects that were vetoed. Right now, the state of Florida is projected to have about a 10,000 shortage of nurses in 2030. That's been a concern. It's gotten better than in recent years, but still a concern going forward. The governor actually vetoed nursing programs at Jacksonville University and Florida State College at Jacksonville for a total of just under $6 million for those two programs combined. So there were some higher education institutions that got funding, others that received vetoes in this year's process.
And I know that the arts veto, the arts funding, is something we're going to be talking about more on this program next week. But do we have a sense as to why the wholesale focus on arts in terms of the veto pen, when this administration has in its own calculations valued the tourism benefit and the economic impact of arts and culture programs?
I don't believe they have directly and comprehensively addressed why those vetoes occurred. I think that would be helpful for the overall public dialogue to understand what the rationale was. But there were some other kind of vetoes made in this budget that I think left people surprised. One was the governor vetoed about $57 million for what are called legislative support services. Well, that affects about 200 employees in the Florida legislature, whether it's OPAGA, which is their policy analysis, whether it's the historic Florida Capitol, whether it's their sort of economic and demographic sort of research arm. So that came as a great surprise to legislative leaders that essentially a lot of their support functions had been vetoed in the budget, and they are now trying to find ways through some of the state's rainy day funds and other mechanisms to try and kind of help deal with that and make sure that 200 legislative staffers aren't laid off. But so there were a variety of surprises in the budget, which I don't think we've had full explanations for yet, and I think that would obviously contribute a lot to the public discussion and dialogue if there could be that explanation.
Well, no conversation would be complete at this point without some discussion of what's happening with the stadium negotiations. And there were some very important developments just last night, really, in terms of decisions that the council is making about how to separate portions of this proposed community benefits agreement. Tell us what we are now looking at in terms of that money that the city would pledge and that the Jaguars would pledge.
Well, just to remind everybody what the community benefits agreement is this was part of the overall stadium deal, was a pledge to invest, all told, about $300 million in riverfront parks, in Out East, the East Side neighborhood, homelessness, affordable housing, workforce development programs countywide. The city would put up $150 million up front. The Jaguars would put in an additional $150 million over time, over the next 30 years, so approximately $5 million a year. This was the most popular part of the stadium deal in a recent poll that UNF did, whereas only about 41% of those polled wanted to invest the $775 million in the stadium itself. The community benefits portion of the plan had about 80% support in that poll and really brought up support for the overall plan. But as the debate began, a number of council members expressed concern about this community benefits agreement. In fact, last week, you know, speaking to the Jacksonville Business Professionals Organization here in town, Council President Ron Salem said that what he wanted to do was defer the entire community benefits agreement to the budget process so that the council could sort of look at that sort of spending as opposed to other, you know, kind of budget priorities or needs the city might have. That was a subject of a special council meeting last night. There now apparently has been a compromise struck between the Deegan administration and the council where that will be divided. So $56 million for park projects will be included with the overall stadium deal that council is scheduled to vote on next week. The other kind of $94 million of that initial $150 million the city is going to contribute for some of those other kind of priorities we talked about, that will be deferred to a later time, presumably the budget process. Council has a special meeting later this week where I believe they'll vote on that compromise. But if that would be the case, about close to $100 million of spending will now become part of the budget process as opposed to part of the stadium agreement.
Carving out some of those elements, including money for homelessness, money for the Out East neighborhood, is that going to be problematic in terms of just the optics of this? There's been great support for, as you say, that element, in part because people view particularly the investments in Out East as a way to make up for some of the promises of consolidation that were not delivered upon in terms of infrastructure needs as such.
Well, I mean, actually, the community benefits agreement itself does not have significant amounts of money to deal with kind of the unfulfilled promises of consolidation. Some of the money for Out East is economic development, you know, workforce development, affordable housing, some economic revitalization, some of those issues. The issues of the unfulfilled promises of consolidation really not addressed here and could be addressed in other places. But yeah, you're right. This is the most popular part of the deal, not just in terms of polling, but look at the committee of the whole meeting council had yesterday. There was a huge public turnout, more than 100 people, most of whom showed up to express their support for the community benefits agreement part of the deal, including and especially those investments in Out East that you're talking about. So, you know, I think, again, that is, I think we'll see this continued debate when the council's considering its budget. They're going to be a large segment of the community that really wants council to prioritize funding that portion of the community benefits agreement when they pass the budget for the next fiscal year.
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, I take your point that there's not investment, you know, in the infrastructure as such, but I do think that there's been conversation in terms of how this is laid onto a community that has been historically, you know, underserviced and under-resourced as a way to kind of bring equity to the way that the city spends money overall.
No question. I mean, again, this is a dedicated effort to try and invest in Out East, a community and a neighborhood that's had historical underinvestment by the city of Jacksonville over time. So it's certainly in the spirit of that overall trying to make sure the city is addressing disparities in investment. I just wanted to be clear. Typically, when you talk about the unfulfilled promises of consolidation, you're talking about investing in things like sidewalks, in, you know, converting from septic tanks to streetlights to paving streets, some of that basic infrastructure that still sure. has not been addressed in large segments of the community. That does not mean the Out East investments aren't important for equity purposes and to help make sure that, you know, places that have received underinvestment in the past receive some focused investment now.
And just briefly, the reason for the carve out is concerns about conflicts of interest for some of the city council members. Is that kind of the driving reason for this?
That seems to be one reason for it. There are several council members who lead community nonprofits who are apparently concerned that some of the money in that $94 million, their organizations could be competitive for that. And I guess there'd been some reporting that the Office of General Counsel had advised them that there could be potential conflicts. I'd actually like to see an opinion on that, if there's a written opinion. And just because there are no actual conflicts right now, none of these organizations are currently slated to receive any of this funding, it seems more hypothetical. So I guess this is just being done out of an abundance of caution so they don't accidentally vote on something now that might vote, that might benefit their organizations later. But typically when you see this discussion of conflict, there's an actual cognizable conflict. Organization A is receiving this amount of money. Council member works for them, and so therefore there's a conflict of interest. You don't typically see it in these hypothetical ways, so that's why I'd sort of like to see an opinion from the Office of General Counsel.
Well, Chris Hand, it is always great to talk with you about what's going on in the city and the state. We really appreciate all of your input and your insights, and thanks for being here.
I look forward to seeing you next month. Thanks,
Hand. Same here. Up next, we're going to be talking to a local nonprofit that's hit a roadblock in its effort to acquire two troubled apartment complexes. Welcome back. Two apartment complexes are the focus of a community effort to bring services to those living in some high-crime neighborhoods, but the nonprofit behind the effort says it's being hampered by federal regulators. Joining me now to discuss this is Paul Tutwiler. He's the CEO and Executive Director of the Northwest Jacksonville Community Development Corporation. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for being here. So these addresses may not be immediately recognizable, but these complexes have unfortunately been in the news quite a bit for a variety of reasons, mold, crime, conditions. What is the interest? Why does the Northwest Jack CDC want to acquire these properties?
Well, we're not going to be the owners. Actually, we provide social services for the owners who are proposing to purchase the units that you're talking about. So just a point of correction.
Sure, sure.
We're very proud to be able to provide social services with the New Hope Homes, formerly Hilltop Community, and it's made a tremendous difference in terms of being able to lower crime, build community just morale generally. The owners have done a magnificent job of rehabilitating units, but it's not just fixing up units that drive community change. It's about actually working with the residents. And so whatever the issues are that prevent the ownership transfer from occurring in the subject units that are proposed to be purchased, we're unable to start the programming that we currently enjoy with New Hope Homes.
And is New Hope the same agency that's going to be taking over these two properties that we're talking about, University Plaza and Vista Landing Apartments, or would it be a different ownership?
Same ownership, but just the name of formerly Hilltop is New Hope Homes. And they will have their individual names as well, probably renamed, start over, give them a whole new image, and excite the residents.
And so they bring in the Northwest CDC to provide services and to kind of connect with the community. What kind of services specifically?
Well, we are very excited to be able to work nutrition, financial literacy. Some of the residents are already trying to clean up their credit so they can buy homes. Sometimes they come to us in confidential ways or going through domestic issues, so we're working with them to help stabilize their lives. Children see this activity and model it later in life. So we're not the managers. We're not the people that's going to be hammering them with just the regular landlord issues, but we're more sensitive to help them understand some of the challenges so that they can go beyond their circumstances to improve their life. And we're very proud of that because we understand just from working in the community 23 years, they're part of our, that's the next generation. What they see is what they grow up to become.
And so your effort right now to be a part of this transition for these two properties, and we should say they're both kind of near UF Health in the Hogan's Creek area. What is happening right now? You are trying to help be a part of that change and be a part of that ownership transition, but there's a holdup right now.
Yes, somehow through regulatory issues that I'm unfamiliar with, the transfer has not occurred, and this has lingered, I think, for a few months. We've actually prepared staff and hired staff to go in and start the working, but they don't own it, so we can't begin. So we have to put all those efforts on hold. In the meantime, I think there was a less than nice article that ran that described particularly University Plaza area as one bloody block. just had a history of violence and crime, and we can't just ignore those issues away. And the ownership is transferred a couple times. I think the difference is not just coming in and rehabbing the units and making them nicer, but working with the actual residents within those units to make the transitions that are required. That is the difference that we propose is needed, and it works so far. And we're very proud to be able to try to replicate the successes that we began in New Hope Homes.
And so the regulatory agency at issue here is the housing, the Federal Housing and Urban Development.
Correct. Yeah. They oversee all of the HUD properties that receive dollars directly from HUD on behalf of these very low-income residents.
And so do they have to, they're like a gatekeeper, they have to approve the sale or?
Absolutely.
Okay. And so right now you said you were staffed up, ready to effect this essentially like in March or so?
That's correct. We began the engagement. We understood the owners were excited about our work, very pleased with the work we're doing, and asked us to expand with their proposed purchases of two different complexes. And we were like, excellent, we'll be able to do what we do. And unfortunately, we hit a roadblock and we've been on hold for a few months now.
And so who is able to get answers about that? Is that something that your agency is able to deal with HUD, or because you're not the ownership group specifically, you kind of have to defer to them?
Exactly. So we do what we do on behalf of the residents. We are not in control of either the government or the owners. We work with the residents and we advocate on their behalf.
But you're here today. What is it that you would like, what word would you like to get out in terms of the efforts that you're making to seal the deal here or to get some momentum?
First of all, we're very excited that what we're doing is actually working. It's about understanding that the community for many, many years have gone through a horrible image. Breaking news from the north side, it's just not a very good, positive image. That we're doing some positive things that is affecting change. There are new people choosing to move to our north side community. They're purchasing homes. We're reinventing ourselves and our image. We need to make sure that we're preserving these units for future low-income residents so that they'll be able to come in and become part of the future of the same community in a positive way.
Is there anything, though, that listeners or people, lawmakers, you know, locally can do to help out?
I'd like for them to inquire, what's going on? Why isn't it happening? We certainly don't know. What we're proposing to do is, hey, we are ready to work with our residents, and they're actually calling us. We're not working there yet, but we're excited that they've reached out and asked us to come out. And there's summer camp programs that we're doing. We're doing nutrition programs. We're doing financial literacy. We're doing a lot of things with the residents because they're asking. They want change. They want things to be different and not the same old, same old. And we're excited that we can offer those opportunities.
Well, Paul Tutwiler, thank you so much for coming on today. We hope that you'll keep us abreast of, you know, developments on this and let us know when that transition does happen.
Thank you so much for hearing us, and I'm excited to be here, and thank you.
I appreciate it. That's Paul Tutwiler. Coming up next, Self-Care Sunday is a centerpiece event for Pride Month.
In the UK, elections are just under a month away. Everyone is predicting major losses for Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party.
And I mean, it is over for the Conservative Party right now. I'm not even sure my candidates are bothering to go out and deliver leaflets. It's over.
Tory politicians themselves are bracing for a blowout. That story next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. 125 years ago, Duke Ellington, bandleader, composer, pianist, was born We discussed the man and his challenges with his granddaughter, Mercedes.
He didn't like to be categorized. He didn't like to be pushed into one way or another way. He wanted to explore everything.
That's next time in Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi predicted his BJP party would win a commanding victory in India's recent elections. International observers worried that a landslide BJP win would advance the party's authoritarian Hindu nationalist grip on Indian democracy. But India's 969 million voters had something entirely different in mind. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
For 1A's Movie Club, we're discussing the film Tuesday. It stars actor and comedian Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
I'd love to talk to death in real life. To be able to play in that communication was very cathartic.
We spoke to her along with the film's director. Hear that conversation next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Self-care looks different for everyone, but during Pride Month, it's an opportunity to make space for those who want to celebrate and care for their community. To talk about that, I am joined now by Kamala Williams, founder of the Lotus Project and host of the upcoming Self-Care Sunday. Welcome back, Kamala.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Alexis Williams, board member of Project Spot. Hi, Alexis.
Hi.
And Charlie Croy, owner of Hand Tied Pride. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for being here. So, Kamala, how do you define self-care and why are you hosting this upcoming weekend event?
Well, you know, our political climate right now has everyone's mental in not a good state. There's lots of laws that are being passed towards the LGBTQ community that have us all, you know, just feeling uneasy, especially here in Florida. And so I wanted to create a day where we could just kind of let that go for a moment and, you know, experience some community, come together, hear about some resources that may be needed to help with your mental health, and provide some tangible resources for those who may be struggling financially.
And you have Kamala's Closet, which is an enterprise that you've undertaken that does address need in the LGBTQIA plus community. Tell us about that project, because that is something else that you do on a regular basis.
Yes. So Kamala's Closet is a gender affirming clothing closet resource that provides a safe shopping environment for the trans, non-binary and LGBTQ at a whole. So it's a genderless store. It's a swap and shop. So you can bring in clothing that no longer fit your identity and then switch it out for clothes that fit your new identity.
And why is it important to have a safe space for a community that, you know, sometimes is having a dysphoria or a kind of an anxiety experience in a traditional retail outfit?
Because of what you just said, the dysphoria of having to choose a gender can sometimes, you know, mess with your mental state. Dressing rooms can always be a challenge of trying to figure out, you know, when you pick your items, where do you try them on at? Will I be safe when I go to try on my clothes? There's a lot of first time things that happen in transitioning, knowing, putting on your first dress, your first pair of heels, your first bra, being able to ask those questions in a regular retail store for someone can be challenging and daunting, not only for the person in need, but for the sales clerk who may not be trained on how to answer those questions or how to help that person. We, you know, create a space where you can walk in and say, I'm looking for my first pair of heels. I'm looking for my first bra. You can try on a dress and come out and twirl and do a spin and ask, how do I look in this? And we can say, that's your color, or that maybe not your style. Let's pick out something else, and you not feel judged or feel that, you know, you're making someone else uncomfortable.
That's so interesting. Charlie Croy, you are the owner of Hand Tied Pride, and you're a part of this Self-Care Sunday that's coming up. Tell us a little bit about your business and what you're going to be presenting on Sunday.
Absolutely. So we do a little bit of everything. Hand Tied was born during the pandemic. My partner and I were talking about how we wanted to bring comfort to the community, because even then there were struggles, and it's only gotten more intense. So we have an emphasis on comfort. I'm described as a walking pride flag. So we want to make sure that visibility is top priority. And, you know, so many people left the state within the past couple of years because of this legislation. So we're definitely trying to make a stand and say, hey, not only do we see you, but you're visible. We try to get all the flags that people don't think about very much, like pansexuals. They love seeing their flag on things. So we love making things for those people so that we say, we see you, you're valid, you're celebrated, you deserve comfort. So this, we're really excited about Self-Care Sunday because we make these aromatherapy rice packs. They're good for hot and cold therapy, and a lot of people will put them in the microwave, put them on their shoulders, they're mobile. So it's not like the newest concept ever, but the thing that we do with it is we make it pride. So it's covered in rainbows. It's something that you can customize, different scents, different prints. We always say every flag, every identity, welcome. And we're just trying to really get out in the community and say, hey, we're here to make you comfortable.
Yeah. And so having that representation visually, it just is important in terms of creating that space.
Absolutely. Even just walking down the street, I'll see people, you know, who see whatever I'm wearing, including like our necklaces that we make with the different flags. And they're so excited because they get to connect and they get to say, oh, more people like me. I feel safer. I feel better. And especially with so many people leaving the region recently, it's like, it feels that much more empowering to be that person for other people. So we want to make sure that we're getting out there and we're saying, hey, it sounds like everybody left. The news has been really dreary, but here we are. We're still walking proud. And ultimately, it's friendly. It's a great community. Things are positive. So like, we want to just keep reinforcing that. It's scary. It sounds scary, but it's not all bad news.
Alexis, I want to ask you about the work that you do with Project Spot, because that's kind of a new initiative. And it's also really interesting what it's addressing.
Yeah, definitely. So one in three people are actually affected by the period poverty. And so
explain what period poverty is.
Yeah, definitely. So it's just those who cannot get the resources to have a hygiene product such as pads, tampons, even discs. So these things that are extremely expensive, there's gaps in the access that people can reach to.
And so you help connect people to those products and to kind of make sure that they're taken care of.
Absolutely. So Kendall Moore actually started Project Spot. It began with a blog. And so with the reception from the success of her blog, she actually began to say, we need to have period pouches here in Jacksonville at different stations, such as Kamala's event, self-care event, to have access to period products in the community.
Well, the event is June 23rd at 11 o'clock. Kamala Williams, Alexis Williams, Charlie Croy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's our program. You can send feedback or suggestions to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We are off Wednesday in observance of the Juneteenth holiday, but join us again Thursday when NFL great Leroy Butler explains how he went from creating the Lambeau Leap to advocating for the homeless. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.